Good morning, friends. Late morning here on a Saturday in March. Welcome, one and all, to the Regeneration Podcast. Here with my friend Michael Martin. Michael, we are kind of doing things by fits and starts here, and I have a question for you in a second. But, you know, it's Lent. I've been somewhat busy. Sometimes our guests, like we have some guests lined up, and a number of them in academia and so forth. So we kind of do it catch as catch can sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And plus, again, it's been, for me, it's been, I don't know why it's been so busy, but it's been so busy.
Yeah, it has.
And plus, I went out of town for 5 days.
Where'd you go?
Idaho.
Oh, to see a daughter, right?
To see some friends, yeah.
Okay. Oh, exciting. Did you fly or drive?
We flew.
Okay.
And it was cold there, and it was warm here. It was snowy and cold there, and here it was 70.
We really didn't have any shovelable snow this year. I shoveled twice, because we live on kind of a busy road. But to say that in upstate New York, so the plows went by when there was like a half an inch, which is nothing, right? So it leaves a little bit. The end of my driveway is an incline, and my wife teaches piano out of the home. So only as like running a business out of our home, I kind of cleaned it up, like dusting a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But south of Lake Ontario, east of Buffalo, which probably had 10 feet this year, it was in the national news and the world news. We're about an hour east of there. We did not have shovelable snow.
Really?
This year,
so. It's only an hour away. Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't actually, I have a snowblower, pretty heavy duty one. Because when people rent the yurt, we have like this long driveway.
Yeah, right.
Goes in a circle. And I haven't had to use it once.
Yeah, crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and we just shoveled the driveway. And I think the most snow we had, we may have had 4 inches once or twice.
Okay.
But not much. Not like a normal winter in Michigan.
Yeah, nothing for us. And again, like, you know, this lake effect, people from outside the Great Lakes, they hear about, especially, you know, we're east of Lake Erie, and we'll get some that comes down off Lake Ontario. But it hit, obviously it killed Buffalo twice, but it hit areas around here. But it's not just like we dodged a bullet. It was just different. It's just warm all the time.
Yeah.
My grass is greening already.
It's that El Nino.
Yeah, it really is.
It is.
Let me ask you a question. Oh, go ahead.
No, I mean, it's just, you know, because people, you know, younger people, will attribute it all to global warming. But when I was a kid, you know, it was, I mean, this is kind of what we would have, these kinds of winters. And then we'd have really severe ones, you know?
Yep.
That's how it is.
And I do worry about the ski hills around here. It just had to be brutal for them. You know, I think their only business was a smattering of, you know, snowmaking. And then those schools, you know, that still have, you know, ski passes where kids join ski club. And, you know, so they made enough snow on a few hills, apparently, to handle some of this. But it had to be brutal.
Yeah, there was, speaking of skiing out in Idaho, man, that's some skiing right there.
I got to do it sometime. I would.
We did a lot of hiking.
Okay.
In the mountains. I mean, I hadn't been in the mountains in a long, long time. But I'm looking, where we parked to go hiking, all these people skiing were there parking for skiing, and they were taking transport up to the top of the mountain. And I'm looking up the ski run, and I didn't see anybody. I said, well, how come there's no, I don't see anybody up there? And my friend said, look closer. And I look closer, and I have like these little dots.
Yeah, so that's a big ski place. Yeah, yeah. We live in, near our house is the biggest decline. It's called Bristol Mountain, between Whiteface Mountain, where the Olympics were held, you know, in the 70s, and the Colorado Rockies. But it's still, it's not much. It's big, you know, it's steep. So you can go east of us, you get the Adirondacks and some places in Vermont that are bigger. Then, of course, in the Rockies, you get like the real biggies in Idaho and so forth. But where we are, we have decent skiing, but it still kind of pales in comparison. But it is the largest, steepest decline, or the longest decline between, I guess, Whiteface Mountain and the Colorado Rockies. But question I was going to ask you is, last night I had a nice, really neat experience. And you get it. We've referenced, we're going to talk about blog entry of yours today on modern love. So, but I was thinking of you last night. One of the common frames of reference we use is Rosemary Houghton's The Catholic Thing, right? It's just a great book. Everybody should read it. And I saw it last night, you know, that I had a meeting working with Synodality with the Vietnamese community in Rochester. And prior to the meeting, there was going to be a mass. But prior to the mass, the Vietnamese community, which is, came over with, quote unquote, the boat people. My mom was involved in that in the suburbs. Then I guess there was a second wave when, a lot of restrictions went up. People who, might have been related, it had American blood just from American soldiers over there. All that way was cleared. So there was another great, go ahead.
Oh, I didn't know that your mom was involved with the boat people. But you know who
Yeah.
else was?
Who?
Was my publisher's mom,
Well.
John Reese from Angelico Press. I didn't know this, but his mom died recently. And I talked to him about it. And he said that at the funeral, it was overwhelmingly Vietnamese people.
Well, yeah. Fascinating. Anyway, I got to take a tangent there then, because when I thought of Vietnamese, our last guest was probably John Vervaeke. And I was thinking, and it's not like that when you guys, you talked beautifully about kind of a, we'll call it a mystical experience where, the horse was coming across and Vervaeke, he had his own with Mercury and so forth. But both of mine, if I've had two, one was at, because my mom worked with, quote unquote, the boat people, one of the children in this family, the Dang family. Young Dang was in my class, sixth grade. And I was playing outside on a Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon. And she told me, you're serving a wedding today at church. You're going to have to clean up and get in the car. And I was, pissed. And it was going to be a wedding for, then she goes, sometimes you get paid for these. She goes, but I'm not promising you. I guess I'm in. But it was Young Dang's older sister. And she also did read me the riot act and said, like, stop complaining, you idiot, which is right. But so I went and it was a Vietnamese wedding. It was all in Vietnamese. And then there was a little reception in the gym out in the town I grew up in, east of Rochester. And it was a mystical experience, when I was serving the mass. And I had another one, I'll explain it, but the other one I had, I was working third shift and had been for a few months at a factory, Sentry Safes. They make fireproof safes. You're scraping cement, they fill them with like cement and a fire retardant to make them fireproof. Maybe 2:30 in the morning, you work on an assembly line in a factory, which I did for a few years. The same conflicts are always there. Quentin is arguing with Kathy, and this guy's hitting on that lady, and all this stuff. And both the Vietnamese wedding, I just thought that it was, again, supernaturally natural. Everything was perfect. Everything fit into place. And one night, all the dysfunction of even the factory, there's nothing you and I hate more when we talk about Sophia and Ahriman is like, reducing work to an assembly line thing. But everything fell into place. And I was just going to bring that up for a conversation with you and John Vervaeke that, is there a difference between those two types of mysticism and so forth? And then I'll even say my thing, then you can just start talking, then we'll go into modern love. But the last night it was this Catholic thing, and it was, I work, there's processions and so forth. And but this was just before this meeting, Vietnamese people. And they used to probably center themselves together. Now they're spread around. When they came over on the boat, they had just menial jobs. Now many of them are professionals and so forth. A really glorious history of 50 years. But before this meeting, you just had in the suburban church, there's one Vietnamese mass, and that's a whole other issue. But they, there's just people in Vietnamese doing Stations of the Cross, and it was Stations of the Cross. And I thought, at that moment, I could go, it was almost like time travel. I could go back. Stations of the Cross go pretty far back, and I could go around the globe, right? Robert Barron talks about this in his series on Catholicism, and you know what I'm talking about. A couple of things, Mike. Respond to the mystical experience. Respond to, you're doing house church and so forth, and there's zero part of me that says like you're not still immersed in the Catholic thing, but I want to hear you. We're good friends. Start talking about some of that stuff that interested me this week.
Well, I think, what you're describing, I think that that's like, I think that was, I talked, I don't know if I mentioned this for Reiki, but so theology to me is a kind of practical mysticism.
Yeah.
To riff on Evelyn Underhill, her second most famous book is Practical Mysticism, because it doesn't entail.
Oh, I thought I had it. I thought it was right. Like, remember when you have books at the ready? This was the essentials of mysticism. I'm back in a different office today. Yeah.
That's
Yeah.
her. But so I, that's kind of what's attractive to me about sociology is there is a very practical, pragmatic approach to it, to mysticism, with it, that doesn't have the dangers of visions or, you know, other kinds of practices that, you know, you could get an angel, you could get a demon, and that, but the demons will tell you it's an angel, right? They don't tell the truth. So
Regeneration
what you're describing,
podcast.
and I think you see through those kinds of folk practices, like the Stations of the Cross, and like, you know, that kind of live in a community, like you're describing the Vietnamese. There's something that shines through that that's undeniable, you know. And I think even I had a wedding. I mean, probably the most profound moment for me when I go to a wedding is not I now pronounce you man and wife. It's when the bride walks in and everybody stands up.
Interesting.
You know, that's what a beautiful, and it's really a folk custom. I don't think it's not dogmatic, right? It's a folk custom, and it is such a beautiful thing. I almost choke up every single time I go to a wedding and that happens, right? Because, and I think that really bears on what we're going to talk about in that article I recently wrote. That there is a kind of mysticism in falling in love, right?
For sure, for
And
sure.
in romance, as we could say, right? Which is it is a as I and I write in that article, what's it called? It's called Modern Love and the Loss of Eros. Is what happened. So what I think would happen, what has happened, and I might be wrong, but I spend a lot of time around young people, and I don't think I'm wrong. That, and I noticed this actually in the 90s, and so it's only got to be worse now,
Everything is worse since the
that
90s.
idea of, you know, carrying a flame for the beloved, or having to earn the love of a woman or a girl, is that what I started off when I was a teenager, right? Is I don't think that exists to a very to as common a degree as it did when I was a kid. And you saw that, and I think that kind of romanticism, there was a part there. I think if we looked at history, there's like two parts to the hippie movement, right? There was the peace and love version, which, you know, all you need is love. And there was a very, and this is what Rosemary Houghton talks about in The Catholic Thing. There was a romanticism in there that where kids were looking for truth, beauty, and goodness. And then there's the other side, which is political, which is actually, I think, all the shit that's in our world right now is actually due to the political hippies growing up.
And betraying themselves. It's not just that they're
Absolutely.
okay. So it's
Well, they
like what
never
they
were
were.
like the Weather Underground. They were
No, they
peace and
weren't.
love hippies,
Agreed.
right?
Although, like the founder of Students for a Democratic Society, who are we thinking about? Anyhow, like students, they were in fairly interesting. But the so you're not saying that the hippie movement, like of being against war, what it went against itself eventually. But it's not like the seeds were necessarily bad. People just got they got drawn over to the dark side, right? With wealth.
Well, yeah, I mean, you really saw this with the Obama presidency, right? Right, all the people who were pro-organic, anti-government, pro-home birth,
Yeah,
anti-establishment. All of a sudden, they came into the establishment, and they were the same old neocons, right? And they are right now. I mean, those are the people, you know, who are still, applauding the war in Ukraine and all kinds of other horrendous
Theme comes up.
things
No, but
going.
you and I will. I'll just never be able to wrap my head around that thing. That's why I describe people. I give them a few ideas, and again, I could stand up people. This notion that some of our politics is temperamental—that's implied in the work of Jonathan Haidt. That reason follows the passions, and I know from raising kids that there's a huge truth to that. You just have some kids that are more like they see that the things have in common, and this other ones see the things just temperamentally things that they don't have in common. And both of those are important. We don't want to be, I don't want to be washed down that I'm just the same as everybody else in a negative sense. So there's one temperament that says we're not. But that same temperament that says I'm not the same could say we have nothing in common, right? And that's the Republican liberal divide. And most of it is temperamental. But I'm a born liberal temperament, but I look around the left and I think my temperament is dissent, right? And I were like, where did dissent go on the left? You know, why do colleges now, in the 60s, you protested on college because of the nexus and the interface and the revolving door between colleges and the military industrial complex. Now it's just taken for granted. And you know, like you're saying about pharmaceuticals and intelligence agencies, it is shocking, you know.
It
But I'm
is,
a leftist critic of the left, I guess.
that's. I used to be. I mean, everybody would have said I was a part of the left 30 years ago, but I didn't change. But it seemed like everything else, turned 180 around me. It was like bizarre. I still can't. I'm stunned to believe that people I at least I thought of as friends of mine could be, pro government and pro you you know pro war, pro tyranny.
Pro tyranny.
And I can't just can't in my head. I mean, I'm becoming like an I'm not quite a crabby old man like Joe Biden's State of the Union
I
address.
didn't. I
Did
just
you
heard.
see that? Oh my
Well,
God.
that part of him is so funny to me all the time. So I saw a couple write-ups yesterday when he tries to get all serious and angry. And I think I saw the press trying to say, like, I think he really pulled it off this
Oh
time.
my God.
Sure, he didn't make it, but I'm sure he didn't pull it off at all.
Well, I always watch the State of the Union address, not to digress too much, because I'm an English professor. And when I talk to students about arguments, I'd always we could pull apart moments of the State of the Union to see which kind of Aristotelian appeals, logos, pathos, or ethos he's using. But I turned it on and I couldn't watch more than 45 seconds. I
It's
think
so
this is the
crazy.
worst thing I've ever seen in my life.
But what we have going on, this presidency is going to be so crazy because that part of Biden is so nuts. And then I don't know how I would describe it, but one is, you know, our friend John Michael Greer, we talked to him about the Trump phenomenon. It's just an archetype working itself out. Like he's Teflon man. He's a change figure. We can go into that again sometime. But it doesn't mean I like the guy, but he's larger than life. But there's a phenomenon now where the number one comedian in the country, Shane Gillis is his name. Young people love him. Look him up. He's really funny. He's subversive. But he, part of his comedy is just doing impressions of like Donald Trump, but he doesn't
Oh, I know the
exaggerate.
guy you're talking about. He does a great Trump.
He does. And he doesn't exaggerate at all. He's saying things Trump actually said. And it's just so damn funny. It's so damn funny that, you know, that the height of comedy matches reality now, you know? You know, because I laughed every bit he does when he's just imitating verbatim Trump. When I saw Trump say that, I laughed hysterically. And it's like, again, my sons are on the couch, like my dad and his brothers are watching the Three Stooges. We can't control ourselves. I specifically remember one talk Trump gave up in northern Minnesota, and he was with the pillow guy, Mike Lindell. And it was really windy, and his hair was blowing. He was blaming Mike Lindell. And he was talking about Sault Ste. Marie. He didn't know what the Sioux was to save his life or locks. He didn't know anything. Again, this is Donald Trump. He doesn't know anything about that stuff. But he just started talking about the Sioux, and how I love the
Well,
Sioux. It's
that's
so
what I'm
damn funny.
part, I think, why a lot of younger men are being drawn into Donald Trump's orbit, because he's funny.
So funny.
You know what I mean? He's really, I mean, the comparison between, I mean, they're both kind of examples of the degradation of political speech.
Yes, 100%. Don't get
But
us
if you
wrong.
compare Biden's political speech, which is just surreal, and how weird it is, and then the angry old man on the, get off my lawn thing. And he can't do it without a teleprompter. And then you see Donald Trump, which is polar opposite, who can riff for 3 hours with no notes, and he's entertaining, right? I mean, he really
So
is
entertaining.
entertaining. I love,
Super
but then he
entertaining.
always does those things like it's your drunk uncle at Christmas.
Yeah,
Don't
yeah,
say,
yeah.
oh my God, don't say that,
Yeah.
right? It's
The
so
other week
funny.
he said he got accused, I think, of not distinguishing or being able to distinguish between Nikki Haley and Nancy Pelosi. And he said because I think they're the same person, right? It's just it's brilliant. It's brilliant. He's turning like, you know, the critiques against him that he's so dumb. He can't tell a Republican from a Democrat. Then his rebarb is funnier than all of politics. It's higher and lower than astute political analysis, you know.
And I have, even though I think it's a degradation of
It
political
is.
speech.
It
You
is.
gotta
It is.
hand it to the guy that he can just riff like that and not be incoherent.
No. And we're in the archetype. We're in the realm of archetypes now. People are they are noticing more synchronicities and things like that. So you had mentioned, let's dive into your article, Michael, and you had mentioned this notion that that you had to earn a woman's love and so forth. So one of the things I wanted to ask you, because I was going to bring, and we should let's acknowledge in the off we did we I texted you yesterday, said interesting article. I'll buzz you at 11 and we'll do a podcast, and letting our listeners know that's how it works. But
It doesn't take hours of research.
no, but
No.
we should have had one of our friends like Lindsay or Therese or Tara on with us. So acknowledgement, folks. But men are entitled to their opinions too. But we'd be richer, and we'll do it sometime. We'll do a part two, and we'll engage these same themes with some of our female friends who are brighter than us on this stuff. But the you were playing up that kind of chivalric, or I don't want to hold you, and yet reading. Dostoevsky, and then again, my favorite commentator on Dostoevsky, and I'm going to say a lot for it. This Powys has a book on Dostoevsky, and I've read Berdyaev's, which is excellent. Lev Shestov's, I still have to read, but I'm also reading Rowan Williams, and I'm getting more from the Powys one. But Powys would say, and I think people will find this interesting, is that in Dostoevsky, that whole chivalric love, Tristan and Isolde, he goes in the whole corpus. It's a million miles away. It doesn't exist. It's not even there. And and what would you put in its place? He would say probably pity is found in there, right? So when you think of when somebody meets or they what we call fall in love, and then and then the book that I have a stack of books that are you on the theme. Charles
That's the
Williams has meant a
book.
lot to me. This is very funny too. And he's and the foreword from Owen Barfield, but. First of all, Michael, the that earning a woman's love, and I'm thinking of there is something to it. What do you think of this notion that it's just not there? The whole because when we talk about love in the West, we do go back to that. Erich Fromm does, and Charles Williams does for sure. But if we're looking for the new Christianity, it's just not there in Dostoevsky. It's not really there in the works of William Blake either, is it? I don't know.
Well, I think it is in Blake, but in a very different way. Because when in Blake, it shows up, especially in Jerusalem, with the idea of the emanation, right? The
He's got the
so
sociology down, there's no doubt.
he does. But I think the emanation, I mean, there's a kind of Christian Kama Sutra in Blake,
Absolutely.
which does speak directly to the integration of the anima. The animus, as I talk about in that article, right, which just comes from Jung, but I mean, a Jungian can't look at Blake without saying, "Wow, he anticipated Jung by a couple hundred years." But I think, but there's something. I mean, here's the thing: there's something really weird going on. When and I've been talking to students about this for a long time, and I always, not always, but maybe once a semester, once every other semester, I'll ask the students, "So you guys date? What do you do? What do you do?" Because by the time I was your age, I probably had seven serious girlfriends by then, right? But what do you guys do?
It's a funny way of phrasing it. Just on a rando Wednesday in spring semester at college, it occurs to Michael Martin. So,
Well, because we talk
what do
about
you guys
stuff,
do? Yeah,
right?
me too, right?
Especially when I teach literature and there's like love going on in the story, or we just say we did the more d'Arthur or even Far From the Madding Crowd, I mean, how can you of all these great works of literature were, and even Dostoevsky, but in a very different way,
Oh,
the more
sure.
existentialist way, they contend with the problem of love, which is like you held up a second ago, Soloviev's book, The Meaning of Love.
Wild,
Right,
totally
which is an
wild.
important book. In fact, when I taught that course on romanticism and love, that was the first thing they had to read. They had to read that, and then we did the Hymns to the Night by Novalis.
Interesting.
Because I don't think kids, I sound like get off my lawn. I don't think the culture has, well, it has, it doesn't have a philosophy of love, doesn't have a, there's no philosophy or assumption of courtship ritual or, you know, any of this
No.
kind of stuff. And I think, I think this is part and parcel of this is the kind of technocratic Ahrimanic attack on the feminine, right? And so instead of the integration of the anima, which Jung was all about, and what, well, Jung, actually Jung, one of his favorite moments in modern history was when the Catholic Church declared the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, because that put the feminine on an almost equal footing with the masculine. So it showed to Jung that the Catholic Church, at least through lip service or dogmatically, was affirming that idea of the eternal feminine. Which, you know, the whole thing of sociology, I mean, that's why there's an erotic, we were talking earlier. So sociology, even though it's a safe kind of mysticism, I think, it's certainly erotic, because it's in the way that Plato talks about it in the Symposium, for instance, right? That there's a, or that great poem by Richard Wilbur, Love Calls Us to the Things of This World, right, which it was inspired by Saint Augustine. And there's an erotics that pulls the, and this is what Solovyov was talking about in that book, right? That what happens with love is it takes you out of yourself, and that you live for another, right? This is, that's the meaning of love.
And he can go. I mean, I've read the book maybe six or seven times, but my last reading, I noticed two more things more clearly. You know, one is that I don't want to reduce it to kind of a heavy technical term because I don't know what it would be in Russian, but in this translation, it's the word dyad. He go, you know, the it's almost like the constituent components of the kingdom of God, or for William Blake's the divine human. You know, is the dyad of the male female, right? That would be the building block. The other shocking thing in Solovyov that we'll come back to is that even with the biblical exegesis, more than in the story of Jacob and Leah and Rachel, but he says if the Old Testament was leading up to the birth of Christ, you know, pointing to it, you can find it there too, that the when you go to the genealogy, there's a type of love that is leading to the continuation of the species. And in the Old Testament, it was towards the birth of Christ. And that you saw that that was going to be Leah, right? The progenitor of Jacob's that gave birth eventually to Christ was Leah. But the love was the relationship with Rachel. And he does this is really wild stuff, right? So he sees not that it's different people necessarily, but he sees one type of love, sexual love is for the, but the other one is about the whole, and they're quite separate, the whole mystery of the existence of another person who's one with us, right? That she is. And the end of the height of personhood, right? The end of the irreducible importance of the individual person. And the fact that he breaks these two apart is something that I think we're dealing with when we talk about what's going on in Western culture. I think we're at, you know, a major cycle, you know, a once in every 2,000 years. Again, maybe the age of Pisces to Aquarius, you know, that again, the death of love and something's reconstituting itself in our time.
Well, and there, and that, I think the struggle is right now between a kind of Sophianic affirmation of creation and of the reality of love, in those, in both ways you just described, the, with the Leo way and the Rachel way. And both of those are under attack by the Ahrimanic forces in our culture, right? Which, and I think there, you see this nowhere more clearly than I would call it the attack on womanhood, the attack on fertility, and the attack on gender, because all of those want to utilize technocratic and pharmaceutical and scientific interventions to compromise what it means to be human. And what it means to be human, this is Mary Harrington in her book, what's it called? Something Against Feminism.
You said it all started with
Sorry,
birth
Mary.
control, right?
But well, she says it starts with birth control, but this is an this is a scientific intervention to destroy what actually works in humanity. And
Yeah.
I think what happens, and I've been saying this for years now, especially since the coming of the Biden administration, where they stick it in your face every 5 minutes with the trans phenomenon, to when I look at that, I mean, I do certainly feel sorry for people who feel such psychological distress
Sure.
that they feel they have to take those extreme measures. But the thing is, those extreme measures are offered scientifically and through and pharmacologically, right?
Yeah.
And so and it's weird. I mean, it's just and the thing is, it's a false or mechanical attempt to integrate the anima or the animus.
Yes,
It's never
right.
going to work.
It's a perversion of it. Yeah,
Yes.
right.
It takes out it, it's actually it's treating a spiritual or psychological problem or opportunity even, right? Or a moment of growth into a technological one. And it's never going to work. It's never going to
Never
work.
gonna work.
It's
Never
only
gonna
going to
work.
result in heartbreak and distress and
And
suicide.
Pope Francis is, I think you would agree, decent on this issue.
I
Even
think
last
so.
week, he called it the fundamental evil of our time, I think,
Good for him.
Yeah. But the no, I agree with you. And I always think too that this integration is, I liked, and maybe it's in Tomberg somewhere or somebody, but like when Michael Martin integrates his anima, that's the definition of charm, right? And and when we talk about the death of love in our time too, you have, I'll make a case again for these political divides that it's part of the same agenda you're talking about. We can talk about the principalities or powers or the archons and so forth, but the left has been reduced to their temperament and not being drawn out of themselves. So their temperament says, it was born to say, and it's a beautiful gift when integrated, which is to see what things have in common. So
Right.
what we have in common with the animal world, what men and women have in common with each other. And what the right temperamentally was conceived to do is what they have, what is different. Men and women are quite different. The genius of the Christian anthropology, the Christian insight, Trinitarian, is that we're both wildly different, men and women, and totally one at the same time, and that's poetry. And that's what meaning of love is getting at too, like almost like a new ontology. But the that's one of the reasons we've lost it. We've lost it. And a further reason we've lost this ability for romantic love is, our political, they're not allowing that integration where somebody can get the poetry
Right.
of each political side. Is that, again, we're divorced from the real. And I saw that it hit home today. I was reading an essay from the liturgical theologian, Aidan Cavanaugh, but he was drawing attention to an observation of Max Weber, and I've never read him, but how shocking it was to me that. That somebody could dedicate their whole life to something that had no connection to the real. And his example is making money. You
Right.
could, we can all get it. You could now be on a computer selling widgets. And even if it's real and it's not just stock trading or working in the markets, but you could dedicate your whole life and your mythos to something that's intrinsically and by definition disconnected from the real.
Yeah,
And
I don't know if
the
you.
real is embedded with male and female. It's
Yes.
poetic, right?
No, I don't know if you caught if you're paying attention to this, but I pay a lot of attention to Irish and British politics. And in Ireland, just this week, they had a vote on their changing the language of the Constitution. And the language of the Constitution, unlike I think any Western democracy, ensures the value and protection of stay-at-home mothers.
Oh, wow.
And they wanted, of course, the archons and the World Economic Forum stooges in the Irish government wanted to get rid of that,
But isn't this even
but the
rare for
people
modern
defeated
Ireland,
it.
which has sold the farm as fast as any country? Like, they were the
Fastest.
last to come out of like some darkness from the old
But
way. There's no doubt.
but it's not the Irish people, it's the Irish government, right? And the Irish people just shot those resolutions down.
Okay. But, and they got something like this passed.
No, they didn't get it passed.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. I'm sorry.
So yeah, they're going to change it, and the Irish people said, "No way, Jose."
Okay.
So yeah, so that's an interesting. I mean, I think that's kind of emblematic of our times, right? They're trying to erase womanhood,
Yeah. Oh,
right? And not
absolutely.
only and trying to erase fertility, and not just fertility. It's dropped out of the news cycle about a year ago. maybe not quite that long, there was a lot of news about the introduction of artificial wombs, right? And all these other kinds of interventions that will F with fertility and remove the sacred from conception. And think about this. Now you know this, but I tell students about this because they don't know about it. But maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago, remember when there was a cultural moment when fertility drugs were all the rage, and women were dropping like eight babies at a time, like puppies, right? Remember this?
Dropping, yes, like dropping a
They
podcast.
were.
Yeah, no, they were. That was a big thing.
And the thing is, it was celebrated in the media. So they'd be on the Rosie O'Donnell show
Mary
or
Kate and 8 plus
Ellen,
8 or
and
whatever,
they'd give
these
them
like
a house
reality
and a
TV
year's
shows.
supply of diapers, right? Remember this?
Yeah, I do. It's a phenomenon. Yeah.
But what happened to that? That's never in the news now. Why?
You tell me.
Because it's not healthy.
Yeah, right.
Because, a lot of those kids would be born, you might have eight kids, and there was even a skit on Saturday Night Live about this. We have eight children, but at least five are normal. Right? Because you'd have three kids with severe abnormalities or learning deficiency or, some problems, because how could you not? And here's again an example of using medical and technological interventions to F up unnatural, procedure. And even though, some people can't get pregnant, which, that does happen, but we know. There's all kinds of problems with that. I mean, and the Catholic Church doesn't allow IVF. Why? Because you're creating human beings to stick in a freezer and just use, you fertilize 10
Right,
eggs,
and that's going on in current
and
events right now.
you use one or two, right? The Orthodox don't oppose it in the way the Catholics do, and I think they're dead wrong on this one. But the Orthodox say, well, if you do it, each one of those fertilized eggs has to become a child, right? Which, yeah, right, that's going to happen, right? So, Ortho Bros, I'm sorry to let you know you're on the wrong side of history here.
All
It's true.
ortho bros went into apoplexy.
Well, no, they should agree with me, and I'm sure they do. But you can make yourself believe anything, right? And it's really it's hor and look at I mean, like, these are all Ahrimanic interventions.
100%,
Yeah.
100%,
And so theology is j just the opposite of that, right? And even though it is tragic that some people can't get pregnant who would like to get pregnant, it is, I have sympathy.
Me too, me too.
I know people my age now who didn't have children either because they couldn't or they put it off too long, and by the time they wanted to start having children, they weren't able to get pregnant. And
There's a
it's
great
sad.
sadness there. There's a great sadness there.
Yeah, it's a sad, I mean, it's a sad situation. And
But it makes me think, you when you began kind of on some of these themes, you were selling sociology as, well, it's like one approach, and I get that, but a kind of a softer, easier way for mysticism, because you're not as open to illusions. But I also think you're probably, again, if we're in an epical change, I want to make it almost a greater claim for sociology than you're making, because like unless we're focusing on the divine feminine, check, and we're focusing on a mysticism of the real, supernaturally natural, and that, and I don't want to say we're trying to come up with a new dogmatic church, but it is, if we were convening and we're talking about something like the sign of the times, it would be something a lot more than one choice amongst many. Certainly it could be like first amongst equals or something, but I almost think you're underselling sociology.
Well, I'm not. I mean, because actually, as you probably recall, in my book Transfiguration, it's a chapter Sophia and Ahriman,
Think it's one of
right?
your best
Because I
chapters, yeah.
was seeing where it's headed, and then that to me is that's the battle right now, and that's when people think. And I've lost a lot of followers, but guess what? I don't care over stuff about COVID and whatever. The reason I'm like that about totalitarianism and those kinds of crazy interventions, medical interventions against people's will, because that is Ahriman. That's the opposite. And right now, I think we're coming to a choice between the Sophianic and the Ahrimanic. That's where, and guess who? I'm not pushing the Ahrimanic, right? You know who is. And it's all over. It's the news cycle. It's all the people who own the news cycle are pushing the Ahrimanic. I even this morning, so very often, and I even talk about to this about students, and I'm surprised they have never heard of it. The issue of transhumanism comes up. And 20 years ago, I wrote an article on transhumanism
Through the lens of Blade Runner, right?
with the lens of Blade Runner. And at the time, people thought I was either crazy or exaggerating. And I'm not saying I'm not crazy, but I wasn't exaggerating,
No, no, no,
right?
no.
Because right now it's all over the place, and it's being actively promoted as a
It,
good.
in New York State, it's tied in. So when you say it's like everywhere, and it's also a place where the microcosm mirrors the macrocosm, it is clearly about the despoliation of Mother Earth. It's clearly about, I was thinking of the issue of coming out of my office and my job. New York State has a referendum for next November's election that's essentially for physician-assisted suicide, right? And it's one of my hobby horses, of course, is kind of the tyranny of the left brain, which is the same dynamic as Sophia versus Ahriman. So read Ian McGilchrist, and you're reading Sophia versus Ahriman. This is civilization-ending stuff, folks. But it would be, when you're in the Catholic Church, we don't say that everybody should be a vegetarian. But in the Book of Revelation, the Book of Hebrews, we say we slay rightly. Something in the Garden of Eden, something went wrong at dinner. This gets resolved as we look, and I'm kind of quoting Aidan Cavanaugh, this liturgical guy, like we're looking at the lamb in the eyes as we slit its throat. But, it's about slaying rightly. That Chesterton, he pointed out that the green blood of the vegetable kingdom. When we just go vegetarian, we're still not bad. That could be the healthiest thing. I might go that way myself someday, honestly. But it doesn't solve the problem of life feeding off of other life. And so, but with the left brain tyranny, which is the Ahrimanic tyranny in New York State, these doctors don't see the distinction between, using medicine to save life or to end life, right? They really don't, and to slay rightly. So, I might kill an animal humanely in the, it's part of life, but I just don't wantonly go killing, and war is bad. But like the left brain, just like Rabelais could prove about St. Thomas Aquinas, oh, you just hit the ortho bros, I'm hitting the rad trads a little bit here. But the notion that you could, with a syllogism, you can prove anything you want, just three moves. So the so even us Catholics, they can go, you can be Catholic and look at the killing issue and think it's right to kill everybody else in war. That's crazy.
Well, this and the, and I
That's
think
Ahrimanic.
what I talk to students about all the time, up and really all the time, and we, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, you think of those classical Aristotelian appeals in rhetoric, right? Which is logos or logic, pathos or emotion, and ethos or credibility or authority, right? Guess what? There ain't no logos in our world. And there's very and the thing is credibility. I mean, you'll have your own credibility, maybe, but the credibility of experts right now is pretty much at an all-time low. It's been destroyed.
Well deserved to be at an
It
all-time
is.
low.
But all you have is feelings, and this is what rules all of our discourse. I feel how I feel. I feel like I was born in the wrong body, or I feel, that that's wrong. Nobody brings it up to logos,
No, no.
right? And the thing is, we know through feelings. In fact, I just watched last night with my two youngest. We watched the first part of Dune.
Okay. I just got to see that because I'll go
It's
see Dune
good. It's
2 in
really
the
well
theater. Yeah,
done, and it's
I
really
heard.
close to the book. But that, that famous quote in Dune, fear is the mind killer, right?
It's what is it? I didn't hear it.
Fear is the mind killer. And I think that's really important
That's
because.
where I'm always telling people that, during, and I still say, our friend again, John Michael Greer, said hate is the new sex. He wrote about this new,
That's a
right? Yeah,
great
because we have this
moment, yeah.
puritanical hatred of hate, but it seems fine in the Bible. But I'm always telling people that, love trumps hate, all this nonsense, that for St. Paul, perfect love casts out fear.
That's right.
Fear.
That's
And
right.
love is contrasted with fear. And so fear is a huge problem here. That's why courage is so important at this time in history.
And that's how all those lockdowns and all that crazy shit that happened 4 years ago, that it was 4 years ago this week,
They used fear and nobody had courage.
Very few people had courage, and people who did have courage were attacked. Right? And it's still kind of happening, but it's, I don't know. Do you think it's falling apart?
I do. You know what I'm worried about falling apart is the regeneration podcast, because we're talking about stuff that quite often gets us booted off YouTube. You know, it could be our third
We
strike.
didn't say anything
I
yet.
think
We're
it's like false stats and things. So
okay.
yeah, so the yeah, are things, yeah. So what I see is, again, I think we're at an epical change. And I'm not saying, again, I'm not saying in the next month, but what's pushing through, you know, and I, you know, I'll just, it's almost like a commercial, but like this feudal thing, right? In Owen Barfield's thing, he said the image pushing through here replaces, he said, if our social structure is disintegrating, right? It is not, is it not precisely because there's no constitutive spiritual principle, what you were saying about logos. By the
Yeah.
way, Michael, that was very brilliant what you were saying there. Nobody said it quite like you did there. You know, logos, feelings, experts, you connected those very well. So I encourage our
Well, thanks.
listeners to re-listen to that. No idea in Soloviev and Coleridge's sense of the term incarnate in it. And in the structure that preceded it, namely feudalism, there was such an incarnate idea. The idea of hierarchy in the true Dionysian hierarchy is a spiritual principle, invoking some measure of interpenetration. But what he's saying is some measure of interpenetration. Barfield's whole corpus, and what Soloviev is pointing to here, is what I've been trying to say. You know, it's confirmation bias, but we're moving away from the feudal folks, and there's a different model. And it is in this essay, if people want to see, it's in, it's not online, Form and Art in Society. It's Barfield. In his a collection of essays called The Crisis of Meaning, which I was going back to after our interview with it's called The Need for Meaning, The Birth of Meaning. But he's talking, and it sounds shallow to people, but he's saying that the principle of hierarchy, the interpenetration there, and all these Jordan Peterson bros, oh, hierarchy, it's always there, you can never get out it. For what it's worth, Steiner, drawing from Barfield, drawing from Steiner, drawing from Soloviev, are saying precisely something new is working through here. There's a different principle of beauty that has become more apparent in our time. The interpenetration of hierarchy is getting is getting replaced, pushed through the feminine with something about, and Barfield is beautiful on, you know, he's going to use you know, Shakespeare, that every line in Shakespeare and every character mirrors the whole, and the whole mirrors everything. So when you find that, it gives us a sense, and they're saying this is pushing through slowly and displacing the feudalism, at least, if not something about the tyranny of like the whole hierarchical thing, you know? Yep. And
Well, I
people,
think
that's why I think we're, it's Pisces to Aquarius more than a 200-year cycle, you know, that the institutions that are falling, like the medical system, the education system,
the
these are pretty
church.
big. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's, and I get a lot of pushback from people sometimes about my criticisms of the Catholic hierarchy, the institutional hierarchy, right? Because it's a mess. I mean, you'll find a couple of good guys in there, but if you look at the whole thing, it's a disaster, and it has been for a long time. And that's like the undermining of authority or of ethos, right? And but the thing is, we've turned that, and even Steve Skocek, is that his name?
I've seen that name.
Who left the Catholic Church? He was pushing back on me, and I'm, because I'm like anti-hierarchy, or calling it into question anyway. Why do we have to listen to these guys? Well, that is the church, and people think that is the church, and so we've turned that kind, that idea of hierarchy, and people will turn to Dionysius the Areopagite to justify that, right? Even Tomberg does. But who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes, right? But that's become an idol,
It
right?
has.
That's an idol.
But see, what they love the interpenetration, right? So they say, yeah, it works in a bad way 99.99999% of the time, but at its best, the top
That
serves the
one.
lowest in everything, right?
And I think, I mean, that's what we have right now. All of our institutions, the mask has come off, right?
It's come off, and
Education,
this is pushing through.
government, where the church, wherever you're gonna look, the mask is off,
So
right? Or it's
the
falling
quote
apart.
unquote left is going back to a bad form of hierarchy. I mean, the quote unquote right And the left is just giving us boredom where nothing is anything. It's all some homogeneous mass, right? It's a crowd, not a community. It's an agglomeration, not an association. It's all these, the worst is the corruption of best. What they're pushing forward is like a form of unity that is uniformity. We could go on for hours, but that's evil. But holding on to this disease form of hierarchy, if what's pushing through is just a new model that has liberty as its theme, and it's a principle of beauty. So all these von Balthasar people, they can go there and find a lot of this. It's
All
there
right.
in Goethe.
And so
It's
with
pushing through.
hierarchy, you get, you probably heard about this, but when I was taking theology courses as an undergrad, the idea, this is a long time ago, this is the idea of corporate evil, right? When we ask, well, how did, the Nazis happen? How did the Holocaust happen? Corporate evil, right? So it works through a bureaucracy, essentially, right? And you go along to get along, and you could even transpose this to this idea of the deep state, right? Which is nothing but a corrupted evil bureaucracy. That's where the real power is.
Again, they confuse means and ends, right? And so one of the things pushing through is the essence of the gospel. The means and ends piece is going to be big, folks. It's going to be big. Sign on now because you're working, you're spitting into the wind. If you don't see that the central proclamation, one of the three central ones of the gospel would be don't confuse means and ends, right? And all that permanent Washington and so much of the confusion of hierarchy is that it confuses means and ends. It allows you to. It gives you an excuse to say, because of this good, I'm going to do evil of, so good. It's crazy. It's crazy. And this is ending in our time.
It is happening. And actually, you're making me recall something. And this has happened to the church. And there's a great critique of this in a movie. I don't know if you've seen this movie, but it's certainly worth watching. It's called Jesus of Montreal.
Yeah, I've seen it, but it was back when I was, when you're watching things, just try and get caught up on culture, but you're not re necessarily ready for it. I think that was me and Jesus of
I
Montreal.
saw it, yeah, because I saw it probably when I was about 30 or whatever. And then, but I used to use it in a course I would teach on religion and film. It's just, and it's funny too. But one of the critiques is, I mean, the underlying critique is kind of a weird thing that these young people are going to do the passion play, but they do it in a very unorthodox, heterodox way. And but the thing is, just by engaging themselves with that story, it changes them and
Yeah,
it
well,
changes the
right.
world. And one of the things that's a critique in it is of church hierarchy, of the advertising hierarchies, of our cultural hierarchies, which are all corrupt. And this Jesus figure in the film kind of destroys it all. He cleanses the temple in a way.
I feel like I have to watch it tonight, Michael.
It's
Like, these
worth
are my
watching.
themes. Yeah, these are my themes.
These are your themes. And what happens after, so the Christ figure who plays Jesus in the Passion play actually dies. Then his friends, who are like the apostles, basically, they want to start to institutionalize everything. All right, we'll do this. We'll build a theater in his name, and we'll do this.
Yeah, so they see
And
it right
just
away.
like, and this is what happened with Saint Francis, right? When Saint Francis went to convert the Sultan, right?
They started institutionalizing
And he gets back to Assisi, and they're like, "Hey, we made a few changes while you were away,
the. Yeah.
And he was
We
so
branded your
disgusted.
name. We sent your
Yes,
name.
that's what they did.
We put
And
a swoosh next to your name.
he was so disgusted. He sat on the floor and threw ashes on his food, so he wouldn't participate in it. And this is, I mean, because there is a human tendency to do that, right? We want to organize it, and we're going to make it better, right? We're gonna organize it as a 501c3, right? Which is what they do, and that's the kiss of death. That's anti-Christian anarchism, right?
Did I tell you where I
You
found, again, it's confirmation bias. Did I tell you about revisiting a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court?
know.
It's really great. Like, the first chapter is so damn funny. So you see it on Bugs Bunny, you see it. But
No.
if I'm
Yeah.
reading it right, so our friend gets transferred back to Camelot, and it's literally Camelot, and he doesn't know what's going on. But he loves, again, he's an American. He loves liberty, where this theme should be pushing through, but we're still so caught up with hierarchy and feudalism. But I would say nobody better than Mark Twain. He does his best to sell to the Rad-Trads, the beauty of this, it's like Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
There's these gonfalons and these men gathered around a table with buxom ladies who dressed like women, and they told heroic tales, and the women were women and the men were men, and there was color and there was feasting, and even the servants looked, placid on the side. And then Mark Twain in italics at the bottom, it's like a note. I wish I had the book here, but he's just saying the servants look placid because they've been turned into animals by feudalism.
Yeah.
Boom. End of first
Boom.
chapter.
Yeah.
Boom. Right. And
That's what they're
that's
trying.
crazy.
We're going towards with techno-feudalism right
Yeah,
now, right?
right.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So they're made placid through video games. This is one of the things they talk about in that article, right?
Yeah, right.
Is that I think the death of Eros is kids don't date like they used to,
No.
right? They're
Dating's
not
an
engaged with the
engagement
book.
with the real. Yeah, the
There's
real. Yeah.
actual statistical evidence that young people are having less sex, marrying later, and not having children as many, not having fewer, if any, children,
Yeah,
right?
you can't be constituted
And
unless
why
you're
is
in
that?
conversation with the other. Yeah.
Well, and why is that? Because in this is a, it's become a joke, it's kind of a stereotype, but it's true that what is, and here's the other thing. When we were kids, right, everybody was in a band. Every boy in high school was in a band.
I was in a
You
band
know,
in
most of them
college.
sucked, but
Yeah.
everybody did it, right? Because you didn't have other things to take your time up. You needed to fill your time with something. So
Yeah.
you would do that, or you'd figure out, you'd do something, go camping a lot. And this is all the things my friends and I used to do. We'd play the guitar and going camping, go having adventures.
Yeah, that's all we did.
Really?
That's all we did.
What
We
if
just
we did?
create games every day,
Yeah.
all day in our
But
college house. Yeah.
the kids don't do that now. They stay inside and play video games and
Yeah.
watch porn, right?
Uh-huh.
And they don't have sex, and they don't date, and they're not out trying to. And there was even, I don't know if you caught it, there was an interview recently with Joe Rogan and Dr. Phil.
No.
And Dr. Phil, who a guy I never paid attention to in my life, was on fire about exactly this kind of thing, that people don't make lives anymore. Young people, because they've been ensnared by the cell phone and by the internet, that they don't go out and have adventures. They don't make a life. They don't figure out who they are.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm sure this is, it's not 100%, but I'm sure it's, I mean, that's, and that's how you find out who you are. I mean, taking, and this is one of the things I talk about in the article, is, you know, my childhood was characterized by risk,
Yeah.
and my youth was characterized by risk. I have to mention, started playing bars when I was 14 or 15, right? Didn't tell my mom where I was going. I
Yeah.
was spending the night at Louie's house, mom. And but that was characterized by risk, and you know, or taking a, even John Michael Greer talked about this recently, because he's exactly my age, and where he would be 12 years old and take a 20-mile bike ride, and no, but it was not a, you know, what's the problem? Oh, did you wear a helmet? Right? Not wearing a helmet and didn't have a cell phone, right? And kids don't engage that kind of risk. Everything is so controlled. I mean, what they do is they do, you know, sports leagues, which is very controlled. I don't think kids, like, no, there aren't that many kids around. So when I was a kid, for instance, growing up in Detroit, you know, so it's March now, and it's, what's it, 45 degrees. There's no snow in 45 degrees. That the first day the snow melted, I get a knock at my door on a Saturday morning at you know, 9 in the morning. We're playing baseball. Get your glove. And we just throw these baseball games together. I don't, my kids have never done that. Of course, we live in the country, you couldn't do it, but I think that's unheard of.
We've still we live in on kind of a in the path to Rome. Belloc describes, beautifully some culture that could be like a village, a small village that's mostly on one street. We do live on something like that. And my kids, four of them, all had those summers they say don't take place anymore. And your boys have those summers that are kind of endless. But again, whether they're playing pickup baseball, it's kind of probably more where you live. I've been to your house, but the we had to fight to do it, right? And people would, and my wife is a piano teacher, and people would see like our four kids and like 12 other kids on our trampoline in the backyard. And they knew because they had read the warnings, from cover to cover. They don't have a line from the Bible memorized, but they know that like only four kids at a time or one probably are allowed on the trampoline. And they'd see heads crashing and things like that. Our daughters used to suntan on the roof. And that's just, It was a fairly steep roof, you know.
Yeah.
And people would say, like, Mr. Sauter, I don't mean to scare you, but you might want to go outside. Your daughters are on the roof. Yeah, I know they are, you know. We had a neighbor one time too, was a great one where the neighbor came over to knock and ask for me in the front door when my wife was teaching piano, and I think somebody saw blood on his hands. I said, "Mike, can you come over?" And I said, "Yeah." And then I walked out. And the piano student's mom, who was sitting in our front porch where Amy teaches piano, when I came back, seemed so nervous because saw blood on the hands, thought maybe there was a murder or something. Like, we live where people would say it's just all white trash. And what he had done is Tom Lee, my good friend and neighbor, he had hit like a pheasant and it was roadkill and he was going to eat it, you know. And then he had been
Right.
playing with it in his pot and asking me if my kids wanted the beautiful feathers and stuff, you know. But when I came back, the lady said, "Oh, Mr. Sauter, can I ask you, like, why your neighbor was asking you?" Because they'd never been asked over to a house by a neighbor ever, you know.
Oh,
Oh, this
especially a
whole
neighbor with
world,
blood on his hands. Yeah.
this whole world is gone. You'll confirm the white trashness, but it was also real, you know, that he wanted me to see this, you know, pheasant he was going to eat tonight. And you know, and again, it's ecology. What he was doing was ecology right there, you know. And we've transferred all that to like weird stuff, but it, you know, a lot of this stuff, risk taking, yeah, but you have to fight for it. And people, in a thousand ways, young parents or young people listening to this podcast, everybody's going to shit on you for every decision you make because safety and risk are the two bigger poles.
And
They seem more important than like truth and lying nowadays, you know.
that's what the archons are pushing. They like right now, right? When they have the National Guard on the subways in New York City, right? It's for your safety.
It's
Or
not
you're
to
going to stay
scare
home
you.
2 weeks to flatten the curve for your safety, for everybody's safety. Let's keep everybody safe. And that's what that's how tyranny comes in, right? And then you end up with a docile population who is willing to take stuff like that,
No, it's happening in real
you know,
time. And again,
and
I think the good thing, we're docile. People would say, "Where is hope?" If I was to answer the question, I'm not saying to, you know, this would be your answer. But the reason I'm obsessed with this thing pushing through, and another example of that, of course, would be the centrality of maybe this epical shift. You're aware that, like, in the perspective of the Kabbalah and so forth, and the Hasid tradition, that the Holy of Holies is the Song of Songs, right? You know, and what is the Song of Songs about? You can't find feudalism or hierarchy in there at all, by definition. You know, I encourage everybody to get to the translation from, I think it's Husband and Wife, the Blocks. And Robert Ulter, the greatest, I think, literary critic to the Bible in the last 50 years, he gives an afterword. But it's a translation that puts it back closer to the Hebrew, you know, and it's young people making love outdoors. I mean, they weren't married, folks. And are there explicit references to things? Of course there is. But if it was the Holy of Holies, it's about the real. It's about an engagement with the real. And if that's the, again, isn't that the calling of our time? What's pushing through? A deeper engagement with these things, right?
And that's why I ended that article with a long quote from the
Yeah,
Song of
right. I was gonna,
Songs.
that's why I was thinking of it.
And why the whole thing was read at my wedding. And here's the thing with the Song of Songs. There's the law is never mentioned, and neither is God.
Nope, not mentioned
Only
once.
by implied. There's a moment, I can't remember what it is, where God is implied, but it's not, no one mentions God, right? And it's about, and here's the thing, speaking through the history, and I've actually in graduate school, I wrote a paper on translations of the Song of Songs. And the weird history of the Song of Songs is this is the book that was, in general, kept away from the laity. And it was the purview of the monastic orders in particular, who would only read it in an allegorical manner, talking about the soul and God, and not what it most obviously is talking about. Me, Tarzan, you, Jane, basically, right? And that's our problem right now. I think I'm Tar. I'm Jane, but I think I might be Tarzan. That's where we are, right?
It's also the that same book. If we think of that being the Holy of Holies or the book of our times, you mentioned how God isn't mentioned. But again, it's not to say, it's to say again, like, you know, my favorite Trappist monk says, like, even amongst Catholics, maybe 2% believe in the incarnation, right? You know, that over time, this thing is getting more and more down here. So it's not casting God out, folks. It's seeing the incarnation get in much more and more. And we see that in like Coventry Patmore, one of the greatest writers on romance, too. So, like what Solovyev, Barfield says, what Solovyev was saying here more explicitly, Patmore was in his poetry. And let me remind our listeners that Patmore wrote a book that is lost to posterity, so sadly, but it was a book where Gerard Manley Hopkins said, "You reveal too much," and it was about love mysticism, you know. And so some of this are still, some of these maxims are still found in the rod, the root, and the flower, and people can turn to them in his cycle of poems called Hymns to the Unknown Eros. But you know, and so Charles Williams was heavily influenced by Coventry Patmore, and it was Charles Williams who quoted Coventry Patmore saying, "The Eucharist is a meal so that every meal might become a Eucharist," right? This is another thing going on in our times, folks. It doesn't mean we don't go to church and there's no sacraments, but is the incarnation pushing through? And do we, you know, God isn't mentioned in the Song of Songs. I hope our listeners are at least starting to play with these constellation of ideas, right? Is
Well,
this biblical?
and that's the thing, and I think, and we've talked about this before, but this kind of idea, what you're invoking there with Coventry Patmore is a kind of Christian romanticism. And what's cool about Christian romanticism is it doesn't throw logos out, but it puts logos and pathos and ethos into harmony, right? So it one is not, I mean, that's what the romantics themselves were resisting the out of balance nature of the Enlightenment, right? It was all left brain. And I say, wait, 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 wait. We also have feelings and love and stuff like this, right? And we like art. Why? Right? We have to bring the, you know, have to bring it back into balance. And I think that's what it offers, right? And Christian romanticism in particular, I mean, the ethos implied in the word Christian, right? Under Christ. And I think sociology is Christian romanticism. It is. And I think, like we were saying earlier, that is the antidote. And I've been saying this for 10 years or 12 years now. That is the antidote to the madness we see in the world.
And maybe again, you hear me beating around, and you're right there around at least getting people to think for themselves about how much of an epical change are we at? You know, so for Oswald Spengler, it's definitely at least that, the end of the Faustian age, right?
Absolutely.
But he would have, they would have that starting in around the year 800 or a little before the Faustian age would come. But it could be bigger than that too, or it could be bringing in, you know, each cycle can bring in another cycle. But the one of the other ways that Soloviev gets to the epical nature of it, or we can decide how important this is, he said, love in our time, the incarnation of love and the way we use it, specifically like sexual love, romantic sexual love, is to our time as to the disordered nature of the word until it was brought under the control of human speech, which is still poetry, not left brain weirdism. So what, Mike, give me one sense, but if you could say, give us the bread of the coming day, if the calling of humanity, the evolution of consciousness, was towards doing with love, this organized state to kind of playing with it in the way that the word was brought under control so we could write poetry and scientific manuals. If you, what do you think of when Barfield and Soloviev say that? You know, what would that look like in a little way?
Well, I think, and actually Berdyaev too. So Berdyaev was writing in 1936, and he saw what was coming down the pipe, right? What I think is important is, well, I think right now, so you mentioned this epochal change, and guess what? And I've been writing about this a lot too. The archons also know it's coming up. So they're trying to rig the game so the next thing goes to them as well. I think I absolutely are right now. And that's why I've been trying to wake people up for the last 10 or 12 years to another possibility, right? Which is sociology, which is, I mean, to me, it just seems like such a healthy way to approach the world. You know, it doesn't seem like it's people who are so esoteric. It's not esoteric at all. It's just
The opposite, the
practical,
opposite.
you know? And it's the opposite of this technocratic madness.
Yeah, it's talking about the intermingling of the
And
divine and human.
all those. So actually on the plane out west, I watched, you ever see the movie, what's it called? A Room with a View.
I have.
You ever see the movie?
Yeah, I see it.
Ever see it?
Yep.
A Room
Can
with
you
a
hear
View.
me? Can you hear
It,
me?
so there's this great point in with it. Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear
Okay.
me?
Yeah, you're slowing
So
down a
there's
little
this great
bit.
moment in the film where, am I? There's this great moment in the film where the male protect the male love interest is in this tree yelling out, "Truth, beauty, espoir." You know,
I don't remember that because.
that's what I want to see.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a great moment in the film, and that's what I want to see happen right now. And I actually I've been pretty much seeing that for my whole life, but I would like to see more young people climbing trees and yelling out that creed,
Right.
right?
What was the third one?
Hope in
Okay.
French.
Yeah. Okay. Spot. Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
he threw out a bunch more transcendentals too, but that's the question. That's the answer.
Steiner put hope as the most important, right? Not love. If you looked at like love, truth, and or faith, hope, and love, he put love as, or I mean, hope is the major one, right? And I do think that's a theme too, you know, that we, and so the archons, you know, one of my favorite thing to do is like, you know, when we say hope, what do the archons replace it? Not with despair, but with optimism, right? Which is the worst being the corruption of the best. You know, and that gives a lot, you know, then it leads us when it's replaced. If it was replaced with despair, we might stop and think. But when hope gets replaced with optimism, the technocratic hope of the future, you know,
Or
ugh,
safety.
yeah.
Or
It
safety,
robs us
right?
of our ability to think clearly because it kind of it mirrors hope. It takes agency away from us, right? This inexorable nature of the thing takes out. Love they replace with what do they replace with love? Love is, oh,
Safety.
care. Yeah, care is a mask of love, right? You
Yeah.
know, care for you. So care can be done. So not this personal Dantean love, but, you know, just to care for somebody, provide, make sure they have a good retirement package.
UBI, yeah.
Yeah. And beauty, how are they replacing beauty? If we said like
With
love, hope,
ugliness,
yeah, right.
with distortion,
AI.
with parity. Yeah, AI, perfect
Right.
example.
Yep,
That's
yep,
it.
yep. Yeah. So we've been chatting about modern love. Any other thoughts on that, Mr. Michael Martin?
Take a risk, brothers and sisters. Take a risk.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think too, you know, that you know, we use this word the real. I'm thinking of all the words that could become buzzwords for us that we need to unpack more because, you know, I can't think of anything better than the real. But
We should do a show on the reel.
yeah. You know, and again, how do you if you love your computer? Well, I don't know. Yeah, there's a great adventure out there. I guess, you know, again, I think look for signs. If you don't think you can do it for yourself, look for signs. You know, when you cooperate with God, if this incarnation thing is going on, and if this hope is going on, and if this pushing through of the themes of like liberty, anti-feudalism are pushing through, try in your prayer life to side with them and see if all of a sudden you kind of catch a wave. That's it's a way, right? To even catch a wave because that's what I feel like you get with this stuff. You know, if this is kind of coming, you know, if we cooperate, it's going to be it can be beautiful. We're probably not going to cooperate. It's still coming, folks. But this thing that's pushing through with more freedom and liberty, it'll look really ugly. So let's cooperate with this and
Let's
then
do
go,
it.
oh, isn't cooperating with it, doesn't that rob us of our freedom, right? And that's why I remind kind of young people that love, which is our theme today, you know, love kind of like splits the difference and casts in a higher register that opposition think people think life is reduced to freedom and necessity. So necessity are things I have to do, and freedom is just kind of arbitrary. Falling in love is both kind of necessary but totally free, right? Not an obsession. When you were moving towards Bonnie metaphysically, it was the least free thing you had ever done, but it was the most free thing you had ever done,
Most
right?
freeing, yeah.
Yeah. So
Here's,
it's
I
at a
actually.
higher level of real than these oppositions below, where freedom and necessity are seen as opposites, right?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting you mentioned Bonnie, because in my new book of poetry, Mythologies of the Wild of God, there are,
Please, please
I
promote.
don't know, a whole bunch. I don't know how many I have to count. I mean, it's full. It is, and I think Daniel Polakoff wrote an endorsement that talks about the, you know, it's a book characterized by transcendence, but also by unquenchable grief. And the book has starts out with a love poem that I wrote to Bonnie maybe 20 some years ago. And it has a there's a lot of that meditation on Eros and love and the role of those things in a human life, and in my human life in particular, but spoken of mostly in mythological terms. But it's because I think it's important.
Now, I think one I had to give a little wedding talk at it had something to do with a nephew's wedding. But I had about 3 minutes to think about it. But I tracked, briefly, and people know these themes, but being put on the spot to say, like, what would you say about love if you had, want to inspire people? And I would see three scenes. Dante falls in love with Beatrice. And the moment we get from that, and there is an evolution of this stuff, the moment we get is she says, he says, perfection walks the streets of Florence, and I know not even her name, right? That when you love, that even naming is a little bit of control. And that he saw her, the first idea wasn't of union, but of difference. She was outside, so the idea of love as being that, something outside, but so interior too, right? It's not in an anxious world. We say there's this two sparrows in a hurricane love where two people are hiding together and hiding from the world. No, the task of love is this kind of outward going one. The second stage is the line, from Traherne so well, that when you love one person too much, or when you fall in love with somebody, it's not that you love that person too much. You love everybody too little. That when we fall in love, we get this sense that we see people as they are, the falling in love experience. You see them as God sees them. That seems to resonate with young people. And then the third stage for me, which ties it to going back to kind of where we began, Michael. I was asking you about John Vervaeke's and yours, mystical visions. You talked about sophiology. But some people would say, and this guy, James Orage, was a former Thomist. You can find him online. I think it's called Inner Explorations. But just like the anima and the animus, he looked at love through the lens of almost like the INFJ, the Myers-Briggs, and that when we fall in love with somebody, we have four of those traits, but we have one that's submerged, a similar idea, but we see that in the other person. It brings us to awareness of themselves with the outness and so forth. But the third stage of love could be, Thomas Merton, I think it's so funny. His famous vision at the corner of 4th and Walnut in Louisville in the consumer district. That's part of the way he tells the vision. What do we know about consumer society? It reduces everybody to a uniformity, right? We're all consumers. So he's in the shopping district of Louisville and he falls in love, right? And we think we consummated that. But we don't know. She lives up in Iowa. She's alive. She doesn't talk. It's great. Poetic. Let some things be, And so, but he sees everybody like they're shining like the sun, right? And he had to laugh. So what do we take for them? That's sophiology. Seeing
Absolutely.
everybody like you're in love, you're looking over there and you're in love with somebody else. That's sophiology. And the other one, I guess that's the evolution maybe even of mysticism, in our
And
time.
that's,
And it was
I mean,
filled
I
with
think that's
laughter. I think that's a biggie. He wanted to laugh. It was just joyful.
right.
It wasn't this kind of lachrymose thing.
It's illuminating, and love is illuminating. And also, that's, you people who have, on LSD or mushrooms have a similar experience. They see the world as characterized by love, right?
They do. They do.
It, you know, as Guillaume Apollinaire, one of my favorite poets, in his poem, I don't know if I have it here. I don't know where it is. But he, I bet I do. Let me look. In his poem, it's the poem read at the marriage of André Simon. At one of the lines in there, and I'm paraphrasing probably in a hatchet job, is a love that fills all space between all the planets wishes that my friend shall get married today, right? So I think it's there's an absolute truth to that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, on that note, friends and family, lovers and friends, thanks for listening to the Regeneration Podcast. We do have some guests lined up and they're goodies. I can't wait for people to meet Jason Peters. He's going to come on. He's a front porch writer who I think is so exceptionally funny. And we're going to talk about Owen Barfield. I think he's been something of a lacuna.
Not
We
good.
want more people and other things. He's great. He, like you, Michael, you're the two biggest scourges of, I think, academia. And, and we have a lot of interesting people. So thanks for listening to the Regeneration Podcast, and we shall see you here again next week.
Take care.